It is 8:07 in the Twin Cities, a little chilly, still 22 degrees out there. Well, now it's time to kind of chat about some political issues with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. Although, Stephen Scheer, you are actually formerly retired, but we can still call you Carleton College.
Yeah, Carleton will still claim.
They'll still claim you. Okay. Well, you're kind enough to do this, and you certainly are very active in terms of, you know, writing. You had an article in the Pioneer Press about some of the takeaways from this election, and you had some very interesting points, I thought. And now that you've had even more time to kind of go over the results, what are some of the biggest takeaways for you?
Well, I got four quick ones I can put out there. The first one is, you know, the suburban sweep in Minnesota. 16 of the 18 state house seats that were gained by the Democrats were in the Twin City suburbs. So that was a really big move from the GOP to the Democrats in the suburbs. And there's a national pattern that this is part of. You saw also similar things happening in suburbs all the way from Philadelphia to Seattle, with Republicans losing U.S. and state legislative seats. So that's the first thing, big suburban sweep. Second, what we really saw in Minnesota this time, Esme, was what I call a regional realignment. Greater Minnesota, rural Minnesota is becoming more Republican and redder, and the metro, which is, after all, where most people live, is becoming emphatically more Democratic. And you see that in the U.S. House races, where the Republicans won the 8th District in northeastern Minnesota, the 1st District in southern Minnesota, and the Democrats won the 2nd and the 3rd, which are suburban in the metro. So that's the second pattern. And then the third thing that I thought was really striking in Minnesota was the electoral weakness at the top of the ballot for Republicans. You know, Jeff Johnson lost to Tim Walz in the governor's race by 12%. And remember, 4 years ago, he lost by 5% to Mark Dayton. So that's not a good trend for the GOP. And Karen Housley was hoping for an upset, finished 11 percentage points behind Tina Smith. And when you have that big of a problem at the top of the ticket, it often affects the party further down the ballot, and you could see that happening in the state legislative races as well. And the last thing I'll say, the fourth thing I'd say, is that there was a real financial disparity. Tim Walz outspent Jeff Johnson by 3 or 4 to 1, similar disproportion in the U.S. Senate race. If you look nationally, one of the reasons that the Democrats took the House is they had raised significantly more money than the Republicans and were able to deploy it in competitive races. And they won a whole bunch of really close House races, and money had something to do with that.
I would like to ask you, you know, starting with that, Republicans did, though, hold the Senate. Is that something, an aberration? And I know that there were a lot more Democratic seats that were up, and that was a problem.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But
why'd that happen? Yeah, well, and this gets to the broader question, Esme, of was there a wave? You know, was this a wave election? And Sean Trend, who's the election analyst for Real Clear Politics website, which is an excellent website, by the way, says, well, you can't really call it a wave, and for the reason you just mentioned. You know, yes, the House was a very good night for the Democrats nationally, but the Senate produced additional Republican seats. That's not a wave. If you look at the governor's races, Democrats did pick up some governor seats, but some of the biggest states like Florida and Ohio remained Republican. So when you look across a variety of different indicators, state legislative seats, yes, Democrats picked up some seats, but it wasn't a huge turnover across the nation in state legislatures. So it was a real mixed bag. It was a good night for Democrats. Did they sweep across the board? No, they did not.
Well, I think, you know, here in Minnesota, I think it was a very good night for Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
Although the actual number of members of Congress from both parties didn't change. There's still three Republicans,
right,
and five Democrats. It's just that two districts, or actually, I guess four districts, flipped.
Right.
And that's one of the points that you have here. that is something that we're seeing, you know, increasingly, and it's the reason the president won. But if you're talking about these demographics, the Democrats are doing better and better in places where there are more people.
That's right.
That's not a good way for Republicans to be moving.
No, and if you look inside the state, yes, you see a Republican trend in rural Minnesota, but that trend is not as strong, or at least it wasn't on Election Day, as the Democratic trend in the metro area. Because Democratic strategists had turnout targets for Democratic votes throughout the metro, and their targets were exceeded everywhere. They just didn't know where all these votes were coming from. That is a wave. You know, in the metro area, there's no question there was a Democratic wave, and that involved more seats and more votes than any Republican wave in rural Minnesota.
In that first district, in fact, we just heard at the top of the hour the fact that Dan Feehan, the Democrat there, just conceded yesterday because it was very, very close. It was not close in the 8th Congressional District, but that was a very tight race.
And 1,300 votes district-wide. That's really a tight one.
And obviously that's something where you did see Tim Walz in his win for governor, which, as you pointed out, mm-hmm. was so substantially better. He really beat Jeff Johnson handily by 12 points, and Jeff Johnson only lost by 5 points 4 years ago. But Walz was able to pick up a lot of counties in southern Minnesota, which of course is his old district.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly that there was a lot of, you know, positive feelings there for him in some of those areas. But the numbers game and the fact that the Democrats did come out, I mean, there were certainly some people who benefited. Notably, somebody I'm going to be talking to tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. on TV, and that is somebody who looked like he could be really in trouble, and that was the Attorney General-elect, Keith Ellison. He pulled out that race, and a lot of people weren't sure if he was going to be able to do it. The urban votes definitely put him over the edge, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. And if you had asked me to pick one indicator of whether it was a good night for Democrats, I'd probably pick this race. And if you had told me that Keith Ellison was going to win by 4 percentage points statewide, I'd say, wow, because he was the weakest performer on the ticket. That means a really huge night for Democrats in Minnesota, and it tended to be that way.
Right. In terms of and you also started off by talking about the state legislature, and you had a fascinating statistic that I hadn't heard before about the 18 seats and that 16 went for Democrats.
Yeah, in the metro. 16, there are only 2 seats in greater Minnesota that flipped to the Democrats. 16 of the 18 were in the suburban ring around the metro.
Okay. What was it there? Was it just anti-Trump? Was it, you know, the pro-gun control groups really hit these seats hard as well? What were some of the factors there?
Well, you know, there are a bunch of things. First of all, quality candidate recruitment. Hardworking candidates were well known in their state legislative districts. Superior funding, which I mentioned before, which was also true at the state legislative level. I think Trump is a factor. The reason I'd say that is that Amy Walter, who's a very good analyst for the National Cook Political Report, has examined what happened nationwide, and she found that the U.S. House races really correlated very much with Trump's support in 2016 in those regions. And what I think we saw in the metro is that Trump's support is not very healthy. It wasn't in 2016. It was greater Minnesota that really went for Trump in a huge way. You know, the 7th district in northwestern Minnesota, Trump carried by 31%. That's where he was really strong. And I think the Trump factor in the metro was definitely a problem for the Republicans, and they have that to deal with going forward.
But isn't it also the case that, I mean, Democrats, one thing we learned in 2016, which I think nobody saw coming because a lot of people didn't think the president was going to win that election, is that Democrats were not enthused about coming out to vote for Hillary Clinton. Maybe they all thought she was going to win.
Yes.
But there wasn't that enthusiasm. So you saw a surge in more Democrats coming out.
Right. But this time it's much more of a referendum on Trump. You know, do you, it's not Trump versus whomever else is running against him, but Trump as president. And we know that he is a very polarizing figure and that a lot of people have made up their minds pretty firmly about him. And there are a lot of people, Democrats and independents, who do not like him. Right. You know, and I think that that was a factor in Minnesota, and it was in other states as well.
All right. Listen, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a point that Professor Scheer made about the fact that the statewide candidates for the Republicans once again did not fare well. In fact, they lost really significantly, decisively. So more with Stephen Scheer after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 8:21 in the evening here on a Saturday night. We've dropped just a little bit, 20 degrees. We'll have weather here in a few minutes. But right now we're talking with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College about some of the breakout points that he actually wrote up very succinctly in the Pioneer Press a couple of days ago about the breakout points from the election, the takeaways. And you said something earlier that I thought was so interesting about the statewide candidates. Mm-hmm. For instance, Jeff Johnson really got crushed, 12 points. Karen Housley, State Senator Karen Housley, that a lot of people thought was going to do a lot better, she loses by 11 points. You've got an embattled Keith Ellison who pulls it out with 4 or 5 points. Once again, there still has not been a statewide Republican elected statewide in Minnesota since 2006 when Governor Pawlenty ran for reelection. You also mentioned, you know, in the House races about recruiting good candidates. State Senator Karen Housley, you know, was pretty, I thought, charismatic, certainly had, you know, I think she spoke well. I did think it was interesting, though, that after Senator Franken resigned, everybody was expecting all these Republicans to jump in and fight for this seat and fight to be the Republican standard bearer. And she was the only one. And I remember, you know, talking to her about it, to Senator Housley, and she acknowledged that she was surprised she was the only one. What is it exactly? And why haven't they been able to, you know, come up with something? I mean, Donald Trump certainly almost won Minnesota a couple of years ago.
Right. Well, here's an ironic fact for you. Which governor got the highest percentage of the statewide vote in state history? It was Arnie Carlson, Republican, 1994, running for re-election. Highest percentage in the history of the elections.
And the Republicans haven't always been happy to claim him.
Well, but doesn't that tell you something?
because he was always, Governor Carlson, obviously a Republican, but he was somebody who really clashed a lot with his own party because he was much more moderate than many Republicans. And in fact, I think in recent years, he's, you know, been endorsing candidates that are not Republican.
That's correct. Tim Pawlenty, when he won in 2006, won by only 20,000 votes statewide, so that was a squeaker. And since then, you haven't seen a really competitive candidate. And I think the reason is that the party has become so uniformly conservative that they are not willing to consider more electable candidates who might fare better. I'll give you a couple of examples. Carla Nelson, state representative from State Senator from Rochester, was running against Jim Hagedorn for the Republican endorsement in the 1st District. And I remember talking to a Republican strategist on election night who said, you know, if Carla Nelson had been the nominee, this would not be a close race because she had votes she could get from Rochester that Jim Hagedorn never could get. But the party wanted somebody who was more conservative, and that almost cost them a representative seat in the 1st District. Also, we have to bring up Jason Lewis, who won a multi-candidate primary back in 2016 and was the most controversial and outspoken of those candidates. And guess what? His outspokenness came up again and again in 2016 and 2018, and the district that John Klein had won by double digits ends up electing a Democrat by 6 points.
Right.
So I think you've got a real recruitment problem here. You are picking people who are ideologically exciting the activists of the party, but they can't get votes from the broader electorate. And those are two examples right there.
Right. And obviously Congressman Lewis did try and, you know, stake out positions or did try and portray himself as somebody who was not extremely conservative. But certainly, you know, for having been on the radio for decades here in the Twin Cities and being very successful, being a very conservative talk show host, that track record was there, and it was brought up once again repeatedly.
Right, but that actually helped him in the primary, but
right.
It was not helpful in the general election.
Right, because it does seem extraordinary, and I did think that Karen Housley was going to do better, and because some of the polls certainly looked tighter, but at the end of the day, I think the strength of that vote in Hennepin County was enormous.
Well, and the real leading indicator of that was the huge turnout in the Democratic primary in the summer. You know, it dwarfed the Republican primary, and it was much higher than many people expected. And that enthusiasm showed up again on Election Day in November and really produced a lot of victories for the Democrats.
Right. And the question is, you know, going forward, will that
will it continue?
Will it continue, yes.
Well, you never know.
Right. So far, you know, and I like the fact you also sort of mentioned the legislature, because you do have this Democratic legislature. You've got the Senate that's hanging by one vote in Minnesota. And this didn't – there were so many things in play here this election that I feel like those of us in the news media really didn't do enough justice to these, you know – the legislative races and the vote for the legislature, because this is so important. It affects so many issues for so many people. But obviously you've got Congressman-elect Walz, who was, you know, saying, hey, listen, I crushed it. I won by a lot. Mm-hmm. And then you've got obviously this Democratic legislature. You've got Speaker designate Melissa Hortman, and you've got this one vote majority in the Senate. What are your thoughts about what Governor Walz can or cannot do?
Well, there's one thing that really does need to happen that has gotten very little mention lately, but that is tax compliance with the new federal tax law. I hate to break it to you, Esme, but you are going to have to itemize deductions on your state form when you'll take a standard deduction on the federal form. So you're going to need two sets of records. Sorry.
Yikes. Okay. But do you think they'll be able to get more done than they have in the past?
I think that Walz is more inclined to engage and find ways forward than Mark Dayton was. Mark Dayton really didn't like to deal with legislators with whom he disagreed, and he took sort of a passive aggressive, you know, that classic Minnesota approach of passive aggressive with the legislature. I don't think Walz will do that. First of all, Walz has a career as a lawmaker, and he has had some bipartisan successes in the U.S. House. He's going to be looking for common ground, and if I were giving him advice, I would tell him to lead in his agenda with those items where he can get some Republican support and get quick victories. Quick victories can then lead to new opportunities. If you lead with a really partisan agenda and run into roadblocks in the Senate, I think everything bogs down from there.
Right. And again, that lead in the Senate, very close. And the Senate wasn't up.
Right.
You know, so I mean, that in another couple of years, the Senate will be up.
Right. And it'll be up in the presidential year. And I think that Republican senators have to be very worried about what they saw in this election. And they have to figure out a way forward that can actually improve the popularity of their agenda and their party. Not an easy task.
And in terms of the tax policy that you mentioned, to getting Minnesota in compliance, I mean, that's got to happen pretty soon.
Well, yeah, the sooner it happens, the more we'll save in tax preparation expenses, that's for sure.
Right, because it gets pretty complicated. All right. Well, listen, we're going to take a break and give you some weather, because a lot of people might be traveling. This is, of course, the Thanksgiving week. But when we come back, I'd like to talk to Professor Scheer about his thoughts about going forward, because 2020 suddenly – we've turned the corner. And are some of these trends that he has pointed out so clearly, what does he think, will those continue? And how will the president have to approach his agenda given the trends that we saw emerging in 2018? All right, folks, let's take a quick break. We'll give you some weather, and then we'll have more with Professor Scheer after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 8:37 in the Twin Cities, 20 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock, along with Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. Let me ask you, Professor Scheer, you're somebody who looks at the history of elections and presidencies. This has been a presidency unlike any other, I think it's fair to say, in so many ways, in terms of sort of a president who really has swings in terms of his positions or what he says about different things on so many issues. Where do you see, in terms of the trends that you highlighted in your article in the Pioneer Press a couple of days ago, as we go forward, because the handicapping for 2020 already starting?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're right about swings and what the president says, and we've been zigging and zagging this very week. I just have to mention that he has endorsed Nancy Pelosi to be elected as Speaker of the House, which no one really expected, and said he would deliver Republican votes for her. Very unlikely, Esme. I don't know where these things come from. But
right, right. And in that news, one of the news conferences that I saw, he went on and on about what a great job she was doing.
Yes.
And people were kind of going, whoa. And then they're right after that, you know, hours later, and then he was also asked at that very news conference, and what about the attorney general? Do you still have confidence with him? And he said, I'm not going to get into that right now. Hours later, Jeff Sessions is fired.
Exactly. And, it's quite possible he'll turn on Nancy Pelosi very quickly, too. So his rhetoric is unpredictable. And I think that makes his future relations with the Democratic House unpredictable. The only thing I think is likely to occur over the next 2 years is a steady stream of Republican judicial confirmations to the federal judiciary through a Republican Senate, because now filibustering is no longer possible. That I know is going to happen. Can we get a budget passed? Can he make any sort of agreement with Democrats? Can he bring Republicans along? All of that remains very, very uncertain. So I'm afraid it's a foggy future.
Right. Well, and one of the reasons I thought that maybe he was, you know, urging, you know, I guess the likely next speaker, Nancy Pelosi, to once again become speaker, because he wanted another foil to have somebody he can kind of, you know, berate and sort of demonize, because he certainly did that with Secretary Clinton very successfully in winning the election. But I think one of his most popular other targets has been Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, bringing people along, I mean, clearly this is somebody who really enjoys campaigning. I mean, he was out there, you know, holding these rallies. We saw them here in Minnesota. I mean, he thrives on this, and not every elected official does, but he really seems to enjoy that. I mean, this is a guy who's a really good campaigner.
Yeah, I can't resist bringing up a story from the Ross Perot campaign back in the 1990s. When Ross Perot was running for president, he had hired a Republican operative, Ed Rollins, and Perot started to get some flack along the way. And he said that Rollins, when does this get to be fun again? And Rollins says, well, when you are on the dais dedicating your presidential library, that's when it gets to be fun again. And that's, I think, the situation that Trump finds himself in now. He does like conflict, and he's going to have more of it because that's his temperament. And the Wall Street Journal, which is often friendly to him, said that he has, I'm just quoting, he has what might be called a likability gap with the public, and he's very good, Esme, at working his base and getting them excited. What he hasn't done in this presidency is convince other people to change their minds and support him, and he'll need to do that between now and Election Day 2020.
Right. Although he, and for the base, though, he may not have won over people, but those I was speaking to, doing an interview with the current Minnesota House Speaker, Kurt Dowd,
who
won't be House Speaker for very long because, as you pointed out, Democrats did take the Minnesota House. But he said that their research shows, that the Minnesota Republicans' research shows, that in the areas where Mr. Trump was very popular or did very well in 2016, he's 10 points more popular. I don't know if you buy that. But,
I do. I do. Yeah, because in areas where, and you could see that in his 2018 strategy for rallies, he was going to the areas where he was popular in order to juice turnout, like southeastern Missouri, Montana, places like that. You notice he stayed out of Minnesota in the last month, probably because he could juice up more votes in redder states than in Minnesota. Now, there's something else I need to bring up this week, which is that a political action committee associated with the Trump campaign, or at least publicly linked with the Trump campaign, has said they're going to target Minnesota for Trump in 2020. And I don't know if they've looked at the 2018 election results of Minnesota, but I don't understand why they would make Minnesota one of their top states based on what happened this month in the elections in this state.
Really? Well, you know, I think one of the things that I've seen in you know, the president's appearances, and I actually was just going back in both those rallies in Duluth and in Rochester. He had one in Duluth in June, because I was there. The one in Rochester was just late October or early October, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He said again and again, one more visit and I could have won this state. One more visit. And one thing that I was doing, I was going back and looking at a story. I was studying a story this week on Sheriff Rich Stanek, who lost the Hennepin County Sheriff's race.
Well, that's one of the biggest surprises of the night.
Right. But congratulated his opponent, Sheriff-elect Dave Hutch Hutchinson, and then did an interview with me saying that he wasn't conceding. So I was trying to figure that out. But and maybe we could talk about that too, because that I think was certainly a reflection on those Democratic votes. But one of the things I thought was so interesting in going back and doing some research, I was trying to get the video from when Sheriff Stanek was with the other sheriffs at the White House meeting with the president. And in that roundtable, which occurred very shortly after he was sworn in, so I think it was February of 2017, early February 2017, the president again, and I'd forgotten this, says to you know, Rich Stanek, oh, yes, Minnesota, one more visit, I could have won there. And I think this is somebody who the president enjoys winning. I really think he believes that.
Yeah.
And I think he sees that this is a state he could win because of how well he did.
Well, but there are a couple things that happened in 2016 that will not happen in 2020. First, Trump snuck up on people throughout the fall. Everybody thought he was losing. Everybody thought
he did too.
Yeah, he did too. Well, when you're president of the United States, you don't sneak up on anybody. You know, and I think you already see that in the way Democrats organized and raised so much money in 2018. They outraised the Republicans. So Trump will be known and will be planned for by Democrats, and that will
know who know he could win.
Yeah, they know he could win, and they will, I think, take everything he does more seriously than they did in 2016. So that's a significant challenge for Trump. And then when you talk about Minnesota, I think you have to look at current electoral trends, where the votes are and which party's getting them. And as of 2018, that's got to be the Democratic Party.
You know, I think that's such an interesting point, you know, that he is a known quantity. And I think when we look at, and I think you and I have mentioned this before, I think that there were 180,000 fewer Democrats that came out in Minnesota in 2016 than did in 2012 when Barack Obama was running for reelection. And I think part of that was a lack of enthusiasm for Secretary Clinton. But I think part of it is kind of what you just referred to.
Yeah, she's got this, so don't worry.
Yeah. Big deal. You know, he's not going to win. There's no way he's going to win. I'm not going to vote. And I think, and that's what happened.
Yeah, But that won't be 2020 because he has won, and Democrats will be motivated in a way they were not in 2016, regardless of who their nominee is.
Right. All right. Listen, chatting with Professor Stephen Scheer, we brought up the sheriff's race in Hennepin County, a big surprise. Let's talk about that briefly when we come back. But first, let's take a break and pay some bills. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 20 degrees in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you for a few more minutes with Professor Stephen Scheer. I do want to give a shout out to the producer of this show, Susan Blanche, and also to producer Shaletta Brundage. Professor Scheer, you mentioned one of the biggest surprises of the night was the loss of Sheriff Rich Stanek in Hennepin County.
Mm-hmm.
He lost by, I think, 2,300 votes. He's somebody who has been a sheriff three terms. He was the commissioner of public safety before that under the Pawlenty administration briefly for 2 years. He was also a state legislator from Maple Grove. This was a stunner, and I think this kind of shows once again the big DFL turnout, because this Dave Hutch Hutchinson, who beat him, who's a virtual unknown, is a Metro Transit police sergeant, won by 2,300 votes. He was the DFL-endorsed candidate.
Right, and a fellow who has admitted to campaign finance problems that came up in the middle of the campaign. Stanek was a known Republican in the Democratic wave year in Hennepin County. If you look at the geographic distribution of the vote, you'll see that Stanek did well outside of Minneapolis, but was buried in Minneapolis, and that ultimately sealed his fate.
Right. And one of the things he said, because I did the interview with him, is that he said, I won, and I can't remember the exact number, I won in 43 cities.
Yeah, right.
43 out of 44.
Yeah, but
the problem.
There is one big city that he's not carrying, and that
right.
made the difference.
and you know, it was interesting, too, because when we talked to the folks in Hennepin County elections, you know, they kept talking about the early voting and how big it was. And Ginny Gelms, who is the elections manager for Hennepin County, and also I was hearing this from Casey Carl, who handles it in Minneapolis, they were saying, I don't think this is just early voting. I think it's going to be really high on election day. And that proved, too, because one of the things everyone was trying to figure out is just, are people finally getting used to the convenience of being able to vote early? And I think there is part of that, but it was also an indication that Democrats were energized.
Right. It was the second indication leading to November. As I mentioned, you had the huge Democratic primary turnout in Hennepin County, you know, in
right.
the summer. Then you have this very large early vote. And then when you add it all up in November, you've got a 77% turnout in Hennepin County above the state average, which was even then a very high number of 64%. Most states don't get to 64% in presidential election years.
Right. But 77% in heavily Democratic Hennepin County. And you know, you brought that up, too, the heavy turnout in the August primary, because I know that every year there's a little bit of a look at whether that primary should be moved to June.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that perhaps would that be a dissuading factor there?
Yeah, I think potentially it is. It's quite remarkable that in August you'd get this degree of turnout, you know, and I don't know if we'll see that again.
Right. All right. And then another feature of the 2020 election year, there will be a presidential primary in Minnesota.
Yes. And this will be, I think, the first seriously contested presidential primary in Minnesota. We've had them in the past, but they were just beauty contests without delegate allocation. So this is a completely different ballgame for us.
All right. And obviously that contest will be a tough one. Listen, Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you, Esme.
Absolutely. Professor Stephen Scheer of Carleton College. All right, folks. Again, I do want to give a shout out to Susan Blanche, the producer of this show, and Ms. Shaletta Brundage, who is on the boards here producing the show, but also will be keeping the studio warm, or trying to stay warm in the studio, which isn't easy tonight. We both are actually, I'm wearing my new down coat, which is almost floor length. It's really cozy. And poor Shaletta is bundled up in blankets and a hat and gloves and trying to stay warm. So, you know, I wonder sometime about workplaces, and we have that certainly at WCCO-TV. It can be really cold, and I think they're just trying to keep everybody awake all night. But I do want to invite you to tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning at 6 a.m. and at 10:30 a.m. Mike Agustinak and I will be there. We all have a special guest on at the 10:30 show. We will have the man who is the Attorney General-elect for the state of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, and Congressman Ellison. He's still a congressman and will be through the first week in January. We'll also do a Facebook Live at 11 a.m. right after that show ends. But a lot to talk about with him. He won the statewide race for Attorney General. He was faced with claims by an ex-girlfriend of physical and emotional abuse, claims he has always denied. He said he wants to be an activist Attorney General. He says one of his goals is to be a check on the president's policies. And so I'll ask him about that. It was a tough race, but he did come out on top of that. So that'll be tomorrow on WCCO Sunday morning. So please tune in 6 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. on WCCO TV. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.